The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Hey, everybody. We have a very good show for you today. We're going to follow up on some of our discussions here in the first half hour from an earlier show this spring as we talk a little bit about generic top-level domains. Joining us for this segment as we get in to talk about the International Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers are three colleagues of mine from Patton Boggs. We've got Deborah Lodge, Mark Ellison, and Chris Adams. Deborah is somebody who's frequently been on the show. She specializes in intellectual property, privacy, and internet law, and again talks about these issues very regularly with us here on Capital Thinking. Mark Ellison's got three decades of industry experience in the technology and communications sector, which means he used to own a really big cell phone back in the day when that was cutting edge. And then Chris is a star associate that assists with patent prosecution, licensing, and litigation matters. And welcome to Chris and to Mark. Deborah, welcome back to the show. And let me start by jumping in on the International Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, also known as ICANN. I know that they've got an application system to get a top-end domain, and my understanding is that it's offline. Tell us a little bit about the status of getting those top-level domain applications processed.
Good afternoon, Kevin. This is Mark. Yes, the TAS system, which is the application system that ICANN opened back in January for top-level domain names, is still offline. A couple of days ago, they announced that they're targeting May 22nd as the reopening date, and then they closed that window on May 30th. And they, at this point, they have reached out to all the entities out there that may have been compromised with this glitch. And what the glitch was an ability to see some confidential information of certain applicants, but they really don't think that there was anything that happened in that respect, that nobody was actually looking at the information. But they're making sure that things are ready to move forward and not tampered with. Obviously, this has been a huge embarrassment for ICANN. And as the overseer of the Internet Domain Name System, really their technology should not have allowed this.
More like I can't instead of I can, I'm sure people have made that joke. So, Mark, let me ask you, because I understand that there's been sort of some congressional hubbub and a little bit of a hearing about this issue and what the glitch is. So tell us a little bit about what's occurred there.
Well, there was quite a bit of hubbub back in January. There was an effort by Congress to stop this process. A number of parties out there in industry and the advertising world did not want this to move forward at this time. But ICANN came back and said, look, we've been at this for 5 or 6 years. You knew this was coming. They had a lot of international pressure to move forward because there are a number of countries that do not have their own top-level domain, such as Canada, as Canada and others do today. Others wanted it. So they move forward. There have certainly been complaints to Congress about this glitch, but at this point we're not hearing anything about any congressional efforts to stop the process or any hearings.
Interesting. Well, let me walk back to the beginning and turn to you, Deborah, to maybe explain a little bit about what ICANN is and why they sort of control this top-level domain process.
Hi, Kevin. It's Deborah, and I'm delighted to be back. And yeah, ICANN is one of those, you know, invisible hands that is critical to everyone who accesses the internet, and that's, you know, most of us these days. It basically governs the internet. It assigns the very top level domain names. Remember, that's .com, .net, and now the, you know, new generic top level domains. And it also is supposed to make sure that there's a stable and secure operation of the internet vis-a-vis the domain names. It's an international organization. It's a nonprofit right now headquartered in California, and it's governed by a board of directors that has representatives from, you know, most of its, you know, top-level stakeholders, such as the generic name supporting organization, the country code name supporting organization, and the government advisory committees. And, you know, it operates through a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Commerce, and it's really charged with overseeing, you know, everything that goes on in terms of doling out the domain names. So right now, it's responsible for the generic top-level domain name, top-level domain, because you're getting the very top domain application process. And, you know, that's intended to open up the domains to, you know, many contenders and applicants who want to have them and to, you know, end up diversifying the internet and, you know, arrange for many more, you know, sub-level domain names.
Sure. Well, I can understand that this is an embarrassment for a nonprofit like ICANN, especially on something important like revealing these new top-level domains. Mark, let me come back to you. But besides sort of apologizing and saying, hey, we're going to fix the glitch, is there anything else that ICANN is doing for folks that are caught up in this mess?
Well, I think they've done all they can do, and that is to get the glitch fixed and make sure that the security is solid. They have notified all parties, not only the affected applicants where there was the potential breach, but also all other applicants who were not affected, to say you were not affected. And the reason why it's so sensitive, I mean, it's not only the names that are being applied for, but it's also a lot of backup information, corporate information that was submitted in the applications to show the financial viability of companies and so on. So, you know, it was a pretty serious threat at first, but it seems like it's been minimized, and I think they're ready to move forward.
Very good. Well, Chris, let me turn to you and ask, how big a universe of people are dealing with this? I mean, are there a couple hundred applications? Are there tens of thousands of applications that are out there pending for these top-level domains?
Hi, Kevin. We understand from ICANN that as of April 12th, when the TAS system went offline, there were approximately 2,091 applications. There were also 214 potential applications for which ICANN was not able to reconcile their payment information. And we also understand ICANN has received about $350 million in application fees.
Interesting. That sounds like a lot of application fees. Tell me a little bit about what type of sort of top-level domains that I can get an application in for. I know when Deborah and I talked about this earlier in the year, I was really interested in getting, you know, Kevin O'Neill or something like that, but then the price seemed a little bit prohibitive. But what could I reserve if I wanted to?
Well, based on the ICANN's guidelines, you can reserve any alphabetic character string up to a maximum of 63 characters that meets ICANN's technical requirements. You also have to ensure that the string does not use one of ICANN's reserved words. So, for example, words like example or test and their translations in multiple languages are reserved by ICANN. Another example is if you were requesting a string for maybe a location like .dc, you would require a letter from the D.C. government to support your application.
Interesting. Well, Mark, let me turn back to you again. So one of the things I know that these folks are doing is that they basically have teed up this one day that they're going to reveal all of the applications and what those new top-level domains are, which is, it sounds like a little bit of interesting marketing. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, a reveal day is going to be an exciting day for us to see what applications are filed. We don't know when it's going to be right now because of the delays. We're thinking that it will be around June 15th if the schedule holds. That's 2 weeks after the application period closes. And in terms of what happens on that day, that is when the names of the applicants and their desired top-level domains are going to be made public, and along with other backup information, and then the clock will start ticking on objections. So that, you know, if you see a name that perhaps conflicts with your corporate name or some other interest of yours, you'll have a chance to object, and we can talk about what those objections are.
Yeah, Deborah, why don't you walk me through what some of those objections are?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Basically, after, you know, reveal day, people who are interested can make certain kinds of objections to the proposed generic top-level domains. And there are four basic kinds of objections that will be entertained. One is called string confusion objection, and that means that there is confusion among between applied for domain names, you know, like if two people have applied for .professional, or if there's already, you know, a, well, .net, and somebody else tries to apply for .net. That's a string confusion. Or legal rights objection, and that one's of great interest to all of us who work in the trademark world, because there is a legal rights issue if someone tries to infringe or utilize a trademark in their new generic top-level domain. So there'll be a chance to object to that. Then there's something called the limited public interest objection, and that, you know, anyone can file one of those, but it's, you know, really based on, you know, a public interest in terms of, you know, is something immoral, scandalous, or, you know, would otherwise, you know, shed disparaging comments on somebody or something. That would be a kind of public interest. And then also there's a community objection, where someone has come up with, you know, a domain name, or domain, that would be associated with, something that's already a clearly delineated community. I don't know, maybe .Republicans. I'm not sure, Kevin, on that one.
Very good. Well, you know, that's probably a pretty good place for us to stop and take a quick commercial. We will come back with Mark, Chris, and Deborah and talk a little bit more about the ICANN top-level domain process. For the moment, we're going to take a commercial break. We'll be right back with more Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Boom.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye.
The house will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. I've been pulling off my email address. I'm thinking, boy, we could get that. It could be at Kevin O'Neill, dot Kevin O'Neill, but we'll see about that someday. We're talking about the International Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers and their new top-level domains, which is why I'm fascinated with the idea of getting a domain of my own to call home. We are joined by several of my colleagues at Patton Boggs, excuse me, Deborah Lodge, Mark Ellison, and Chris Adams. Chris, I want to pick things back up with you and ask you about applicants registering for a couple of perhaps popular strings, .pro and .professional. Tell us a little bit about what happens there.
Sure, Kevin. Well, .pro already exists as a top-level domain for licensed and certified professionals. So, for example, if you provided your bar card and filled out an application, you could get the domain kevinoneill.pro. With respect to the .professional, the owner of the .pro might object because the two strings are similar. The owner of the .pro will file an application. Typically, it's about 500 words or 20 pages with the International Center for Dispute Resolution in New York. The owner of the .pro GTLD will pay a $2,750 filing fee, and if they desire a hearing, they'll also pay an optional $1,250 fee.
Gotcha. Well, let me jump over to you, Deborah, and say, so obviously one of the things that ICANN must be looking at is whether or not there's trademark copyright infringements when you're trying to, you know, to register a string. So if you took a very popular company like an Apple and you tried to register something at .apple, what would happen?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And, you know, many of our clients with, you know, valuable trademarks are concerned about that. And, you know, ICANN itself is not going to screen for that because it views that as sort of, you know, an issue that the trademark owners have to deal with. And that's exactly why, you know, this legal rights objection period is so important. You know, the dot Apple, if somebody tries to get that, you know, who's not, you know, Apple computers, then certainly, you know, they're going to be concerned. And by the way, I have no idea whether or not they've applied for that. We do not, you know, do that, for them. But it's, just a hypothetical. And, you know, so they would, if, you know, object to a dot Apple applicant, that wasn't with their authority, and as the owner of those trademark rights, they could file an objection against any conflicting application in English with WIPO, which is the World Intellectual Property Organization based in Switzerland. I might say that ICANN has divided up, you know, the arbitration panels among who is going to determine the objections and do the resolution of the objections. And for the legal rights objections, that will be WIPO. And anyone who wants to file an objection on the basis of legal rights have has 7 months from reveal day to file the objection. It will not be cheap. The filing fees for each objection range from $1,000 to $5,000, and the arbitrators have to be paid for too. And you know, it's estimated that it's going to be like $10,000 from each party. So the full, you know, adjudication is likely to be, you know, north of $100,000. So it's something that is not going to be cheap, as Mark indicated in the beginning. You know, many trademark owners and sort of the trademark protection world was very concerned about, you know, the whole top-level domain process because of trademark infringement possibilities. So that's one route, and I just also want to mention that there's another way for trademark owners to protect their marks, which will be after the top-level domains are doled out, then there will be a trademark clearinghouse that trademark owners can register with, and that's supposed to be a screen for, you know, the sort of downstream domain names. But we're talking now about the top-level ones.
Interesting. And what kind of criteria will this WIPO consider in all this?
WIPO has already announced the criteria that it's going to use, and it has a list of about 8 basic issues that it will consider and direct its arbitrators to consider. And many of them are very similar to trademark infringement principles. You know, whether the applied for GTLD is similar or identical to another trademark that the objector owns, whether the applied for GTLD owner was doing that in good faith, and what kind of goods and products it's going to be used for, and, you know, all sorts of things that go into, you know, the nature of the use and, you know, who has the rights and who should be given the rights. And one thing, this is a big deal because generally trademarks and trademark protections are determined on a, you know, location, by location basis. It's geographic based rights. And that's not true, you know, when you're talking about the global internet. So it's going to be, a series of proceedings that many of us in the trademark world are going to watch very carefully.
Mark, let me ask you something. I know there's an issue with what's called string confusion. What the heck is that?
Well, you know, I think let me just touch on something that that Deborah just mentioned, and that is that, you know, if you look at the trademark world, for example, with Apple, you've got Apple computers, and then you've got the Apple that's associated with the Beatles music, and they're both able to use that because they're two different products, two different areas. In this case, if one of them filed for .Apple and got it, then that usage is going to be exclusive on the World Wide Web, and they can't use Apple again as a .Apple. So it's different than the trademark use. So that's why, you know, confusion is important, because if there's two words that sound alike, if somebody did apples, you know, they're going to have to fight it out. And under the rules that ICANN has, something can be confusing technically, even if the English words aren't the same. So, I mean, you could have dot Adams, and it could be seen as confusing to dot Kevin, depending on how the names are translated into the technical characters that are used. So you've got confusion and battles potentially happening at multiple levels here. They're not going to be always as obvious as one would think of looking at, does this apple confuse with another apple? So it's not apples to apples. It could be apples to oranges in this case.
All right. Anything else we need to know about string confusion there, Mark?
You know, not really. I think that it's just it's something that once these names come out on reveal day, it's not going to be necessarily something that hits you between the eyes. There's going to have to be some technical examination as well.
Well then, Chris, what's going to happen in the evaluation process? Mark talks about technical examination, but you got this this period of time between the window closing for actually applying for these new top level domains and the reveal day. What kind of process is ICANN going through to evaluate things, and what will happen if I want to object to somebody when that window opens?
Okay. Well, as we discussed during our last show, if ICANN received more than 500 applications, it was going to implement a batching system where it would process the first batch of 500 applications and subsequent batches of 400 applications. Because we understand ICANN has received 2,091 applications at a minimum, we anticipate the applications will be processed in batches. For each batch of applications, they will go through several stages, with each stage having its own estimated duration or time frame. You have the administrative check, where ICANN will just check to ensure that the applicant has completed the application properly. You have the initial evaluation, which is important. This is where ICANN will evaluate the string that the applicant applied for and then evaluate the applicant. So, for example, with the .pro example we discussed earlier, at this level, ICANN would reject the string because you potentially have another .pro string registered. You also have the string contention, which Mark just discussed. You have the objection period, which Deborah just discussed, which will run for about 7 months. And if you're successful, you have what's called a pre-delegation period. So the shortest time frame for an application would be approximately 9 months if there are no issues. If there are issues or if you have a complex application, it will take about 22 months. And you should also remember this is per batch.
I see. Well, talk to me, Chris, a little bit more about what the pre-delegation process is all about.
Well, the pre-delegation process, after an application survives all of ICANN's evaluation steps, then this is the point where an applicant will enter into what's called a registry agreement with ICANN. And then the applicant will be expected to pass some technical tests before their GTLD is delegated. The registry agreement lasts for approximately 10 years.
Interesting. Well, so, Mark, the reveal day comes. I actually win something. Tell me what kind of agreement that I'll have to enter into with ICANN.
Well, once the process is done and passes all the evaluation, you have an agreement that you'll meet the technical test, that you can perform the registry services. It's a fairly deep and involved commitment that you're making here, and presumably a lot of this will get filtered out as the application process is completed.
Interesting. Well, I got time, Mark, for one last question. The registry, how will it be used once a top-level domain's approved?
There's two types. There's an open and closed, and open registries are ones that will allow members of the public to use them, such as we have today with .com, .org, .edu, with whatever restrictions apply to those. And then there'll be others that are closed registries, such as maybe, .Ford or .General Motors or something like that that's for a specific marketing purpose or, company purpose. So it will be interesting to see, it's obvious for those that are the closed that they're going to be used for sales marketing, or perhaps you could have your own website associated with an account that you have someplace, but it will be interesting to see what's available to the public beyond the existing ones that we have today that may be creative and very useful.
Gotcha. Well, that's going to have to do it. Deborah, Mark, Chris, appreciate you joining us and talking about generic top-level domains. We're going to be back in just a minute. We'll go north of the border to talk about doing business in Canada. Keep it here on Capital Thinking.
Thanks, Kevin.
Bye. Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions.
Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about this show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, now we're going to talk a little bit about doing business in Canada, and more specifically in the culturally distinct province of Quebec. This is the second week in a row that we've got lawyers from the Canadian law firm of McCarthy Tetrall, and we'll have two of them on here for the second half hour. Joining us for this segment is Rachel Solium. Rachel's a partner in the Labor and Employment Group of McCarthy Tetrall's Montreal office. She focuses exclusively on management-side labor and employment law issues, an emphasis on providing employment advice for corporate restructurings and mergers and acquisitions, which I suspect means she might be getting busy as those sectors of the economy start to tick up. Today she's going to talk to us a little bit about the key points for doing business in the province of Quebec. That's the second largest administrative division in the great nation of Canada, and one where they have a predominant and official language of French. So, Rachel, welcome to the show. I know no French outside of French fries, so I won't try and impress you with my suave understanding of that great language. But let me ask you a little bit about doing business in Quebec with its own language, its own distinct culture, a little bit separate and apart from the rest of Canada. What does that have to do with the differing legal regime in that province compared to the greater nation?
Well, hi, Kevin. First of all, happy to be with you today. Happy to be on the show. Indeed, Quebec is distinct in many ways, language being probably the most obvious one. From a purely legal perspective, though, Quebec is also distinct in very significant ways. So let me start off by saying that, and I'm a labor and employment lawyer, so labor and employment in Canada is provincially regulated. So except for those very specific industries that come under the constitutional jurisdiction of the federal government, and examples of those would be aviation, banking, interprovincial transport, for example, the vast majority of employers have to look to the laws of each specific province in which they're doing business and in which they have employees to determine the legal framework that applies to them with respect to the operations in that province. But even within that provincial structure, Quebec is rather unique in that while the other provinces operate on a traditional common law legal system, Quebec is a civilian system. So Quebec is based on the French tradition of the Napoleonic Code, which means that we have the Civil Code of Quebec that is kind of the general body of law and contains all of the general rights and obligations of citizens and companies within the province. And then you supplement that, obviously, with specific statutes that apply in various with respect to various different issues. And also, Quebec has its own Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms that applies to all individuals and companies in Quebec. So that may not mean a whole lot to the non-lawyer, except that if you're doing business in Quebec and if you have employees in Quebec, you cannot take for granted that principles that have been developed in the common law provinces and that trends that tend to be followed from one common law province to the other necessarily apply in Quebec. That's not to say that there isn't quite a bit of overlap and quite a bit of sharing of legal trends and principles between the common law provinces and Quebec, but certainly you cannot take it for granted, and you always in Quebec have to look to the specific Quebec rules and see if there's anything particular that will govern a specific situation.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about it. So if I take my corporation and we go north of the border into the Quebec market, what are some of the issues that I'm going to face distinctive there from an employment law perspective?
Well, as you said in the intro, a significant part of my practice is focused on providing advice to mostly U.S.-based companies that are coming into the province of Quebec and typically by way of an acquisition or other commercial transaction that results in them either having a subsidiary or having active operations in Quebec. And what I often see with U.S. clients is that the first big surprise that comes to them in that process is the fairly broad successor employer rules that we have in Quebec. It's kind of the combined effect of various statutory provisions that result in many cases there being an automatic transfer of employment to the acquirer by operation of law. Now, that's typically the case if you're buying the shares of a company. But in Quebec, it applies both to unionized employees and non-unionized employees, and in a quite a unique way, will often apply also when you're only acquiring assets. So if the assets that you are acquiring in Quebec taken together constitute most of the necessary elements to continue a business or a part of a business as a going concern, then the employees attached to that business will, by operation of law, transfer to the acquirer.
All right, so if I'm a company, I want to terminate some employees, I want to downsize, what kind of steps do I have to go through? How difficult is that to do in Quebec?
Well, I mean, at the front end, when you're acquiring a business or when you're coming into the province, it means the successor employer rules. The result is that you may be required to take on employees without any form of selection process, and at that point, you may be restricted in your ability to change terms and conditions of employment. So, if you end up with employees that you don't necessarily need, don't necessarily want, if there are certain redundancies in your structure, and you then have to terminate employees, the second big surprise that employers get is that Quebec is actually a very employee protectionist jurisdiction when it comes to terminations of employment. So under the Civil Code, there is this general notion that an employer can terminate employment by giving reasonable notice, which is either working notice or a payment in lieu of notice. That being said, under our labor standards legislation, there is a very specific protection, job protection, for employees who have two or more years of continuous service with a single employer. And what that essentially translates into is that employers cannot terminate the employment of an employee with two or more years of service without either demonstrating just cause or demonstrating that there are valid and bona fide economic reasons for terminating that employment. So there are specific recourses then that employees can exercise that carry with them not only potentially damages and monetary compensation, but also a right of reinstatement.
Very interesting. Well, we mentioned a couple times, you know, Quebec, obviously French-speaking province. How does that factor into employment relationships?
Well, Quebec is a French-speaking province, and just to give you a little bit of context on it, population of about 7.5 million people, 82% of those are French-speaking, and their mother tongue is French. By comparison, only about 8% are English, have English as their maternal language. So it is a predominantly French environment, and some would say by virtue of that, it just makes good business sense to adapt your operations to that French environment. But if that weren't reason enough, there are very strong legislative protections of the French language in a wide range of areas, signage, corporate names, but also specifically in employee relations. So, for instance, employees have a fundamental right to carry on their work in French, and correlatively, employers have specific obligations to employees with respect to the use of the French language. So all written communications to your employees, and that's, you know, general mass communications to employees, have to be in French. Any offers, written offers of employment or promotion, have to be in French. If you're in a unionized workplace, collective agreements have to be drafted in French. And as a general rule, employers can only require an employee to be functional in English or to work in English if the employer can demonstrate that that is a bona fide occupational requirement, so that the specific position and the nature of that employee's duties require the employee to work in English or any language other than French, for that matter. And there are also specific contract-specific documents that by law have to be drafted in French. So some of those are what we call a contract of adhesion, which is any contract that is drafted by one party and is not a negotiated contract, so any printed form contract, as well employment applications and release and discharge documents necessarily have to be drafted and provided to an employee in French. And then for organizations that have that reach certain thresholds of employees, and the magic number is 50. So if you have 50 employees in the province of Quebec, then you fall into an obligation to register with the Office of the French Language, and that triggers much more onerous obligations to generalize the use of French in the business, and much more targeted follow-up by the Office of the French Language to ensure that you are promoting the use of French and are generalizing the use of French in the organization.
Rachel, I just have enough time for you to give folks your email address and tell them how to get in contact with you if they want to talk about doing business in Quebec.
Absolutely. So the email address is rsolyom, R-S-O-L-Y-O-M, at mccarthy.ca. Listeners can take a look at our website at mccarthy.ca and can contact any one of our lawyers through there.
All right. Rachel Solyom, partner in the Labor and Employment Group of McCarthy Tétrault's Montreal office, and really appreciate you coming on and educating us a little bit about Quebec. We're going to be back with one of your colleagues from another office as well here just in a moment after this commercial break here on Capital Thinking.
Thanks very much.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We were in Montreal. Now we're going to skip over to Toronto, and our guest is Lara Nathans, the co-chair of McCarthy Tetrall's National Consumer and Retail Group in their Toronto office. Lara regularly acts on mergers and acquisitions, corporate financial matters, and corporate reorganizations, providing advice to public company clients on security laws requirements there in Canada. She's got a lot of experience with U.S. retailers, which seem to be crossing the border in this sort of slowly reviving economy and starting to do more business in the Canadian market. So, Lara, welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit about the invasion of U.S. retailers.
Thank you very much. Yes, we've seen over the past several years, maybe slowly at first and now an increasing number, U.S. retailers wanting to expand into Canada. You know, some examples of those from a few years ago are Pottery Barn and Williams Sonoma, but then more recently, of course, we've seen Crate and Barrel and J. Crew, and then others are in talks as well, such as Nordstrom, and as many know, Target's purchased a number of leases and is entering the Canadian market soon.
Oh, and, very good. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, Lara, tell me, so a company like Target moving north of the border, what are some of the issues that face them or other players entering the Canadian retail and consumer products industries?
Well, you know, there are a lot of different ways that retailers can enter the market. So some of them are choosing to do that. Like Target, for example, is doing that through purchasing a number of leases from Zellers, which was a similarly priced store. Others may choose to acquire an existing retailer. They might wait until leases have expired and try to find space that way. But, you know, there are a number of issues that U.S. companies and retailers in particular need to think about when they're coming to Canada. I think a lot of Americans, I'm a dual citizen myself, but think that the U.S. is very similar to Canada. We're geographically proximate, have similar consumer patterns, but the laws can be quite different. So a few things they need to consider, you know, one would be the corporate laws and whether they need resident directors, for example, certain jurisdictions in Canada require a certain percentage of directors to be resident there. How the business is structured when they're entering Canada is also of significance. So, for example, the retailer may choose to purchase a Canadian company. It may choose to open what's called a branch office and operate business directly from the U.S. into Canada, or it may incorporate a Canadian subsidiary. And the choice of jurisdiction there is important for a number of reasons, one of which is the residency requirement that I mentioned.
Sure.
Then there are a number of, we have a statute that's a foreign investment statute called the Investment Canada Act, and regardless of how you enter, the investment may become subject to that act, which require either review or notification in terms of the transaction. And then, of course, in the case of retailers, they need to become familiar with the Canadian legislation that might differ from that in the U.S. So, for example, you know, our labor and employment laws are different. We have privacy requirements, labeling requirements, and, you know, when they're first coming here, real property laws as well may differ.
Sure. And what does all this mean, this invasion from the South, mean for Canadian companies already in the industries?
Well, you know, there's a few things. I think you can see it as either a challenge or an opportunity. I mean, it certainly will increase competition, and there are only so many consumers and bodies that can come into the stores. But by another stretch, it can also be seen as an opportunity. So, for example, if a retailer such as Target comes and it's seen as attractive, then it could pull other pull more customers into, say, a shopping center. So
sure, it's a magnet.
There's ups and downs, right?
Yeah, Target's a magnet as an anchor store, I'm sure. Well, you know, we just had one of your colleagues on from the Montreal shop in the last segment, and one of the things we were talking about was sort of the uniqueness of doing business in Quebec. Obviously, Canada, much like the United States, is a wildly divergent country, both in terms of your population, the cultures, the language, etc. So talk to us a little bit about how you counsel clients and companies on doing business on a province-by-province basis inside Canada.
Well, there are a few things. You know, our constitution is set up so that some things are governed federally and other things are governed provincially. And when a company comes to Canada, it may choose to come to one province first. So a retailer is a perfect example because it may choose to use a test market such as Toronto, in which case it must become familiar with Ontario laws and so on. Or, you know, we were just talking about Target a few minutes ago, and the media that I've read says that it's opening several stores at the same time, which means you'd need knowledge across the country. And it's a matter of getting up to speed by learning about the laws in every jurisdiction that you're planning to establish yourself in. And as Rachel mentioned, Quebec is often quite different. They're governed by the civil code and have different language requirements. So familiarizing yourself with Ontario wouldn't necessarily be equivalent to familiarizing yourself with Quebec, and it's important to engage counsel in both jurisdictions.
Sure, I can see that. Well, tell us a little bit, Lara, about some of the other ongoing requirements that if I'm a business, big or small, that I need to be aware of when I'm making the decision about starting to operate in Canada, and perhaps, again, jurisdiction to jurisdiction, some things I need to take into account.
Well, I think some things that would be needed to take into account is, first of all, where you decide to incorporate. So recognizing that the corporate statutes, though they're similar across the country, there are differences, and extra provincial requirements are different as well. One big piece for retailers as well, of course, is privacy, and that may have particular jurisdictional differences. And finally, you know, the real property laws can be sensitive from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And increasingly, how retailers manage data and deal with their customers are becoming increasingly important as well.
Very good. Well, just a little bit of time left. Tell us a little bit more about your practice there and how we can get in touch with you.
Sure, absolutely. So, as you mentioned, I co-chair our consumer and retail industry group. We have lawyers that practice in that group from across the country and from all different practice groups. My practice in particular is focused on acquisitions and ongoing advice to public companies, compliance with securities laws, and so on. And to get in touch with me, I think Rachel gave you our website, which is mccarthy.ca. And my email address is lnathans, L-N-A-T-H-A-N-S, at mccarthy.ca.
Well, terrific. Lara, thank you for coming on, talking to us about the opportunity for companies to go north of the border and open in the retail and consumer products segment. Enjoyed learning a little bit about that. We're going to be back next week with more Capital Thinking. Hope everyone has a terrific weekend, and keep it here on the Voice America Business Network. We'll see you next Thursday.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.